You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Very, very interesting. The Incident Command System of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, created back during the Carter administration. And the reason why is because there was all these different agencies that were dealing with all these different problems in different ways. They were not coordinated with each other. Disasters were being compounded. And not only that, when there were multiple states involved, the states had no system for coordinating things. The Incident Command System, reading from their website, allows for the integration of facilities, equipment, personnel, procedures. But isn't this the federal government taking it over? Here's from the FAQ from the fact file. How does the NIS relate to local incident command? A basic premise of this is that all incidents begin and end locally. NIMS does not take command away from state and local authorities. The federal government supports state and local authorities when their resources are overwhelmed or anticipated to be overwhelmed. The intention of the federal government in these situations is not to command the response, but rather to support the affected local, tribal, and or state governments. So that's how it's working. Here's what Governor Chris Christie, the Republican who will probably run for president of the United States in 2016, had to say about it.
How does that help you?
Helps us tremendously. I spoke to the president three times yesterday. He called me for the last time at midnight last night asking what he could do. I said if he could expedite designating New Jersey as a major disaster area, that would help us to get federal money and resources in here as quickly as possible to help clean up the damage here. The president was great last night. He said he would get it done. At 2 a.m., I got a call from FEMA to answer a couple of final questions, and then he signed the declaration this morning.
There you go. And this is probably one of the most hard right Republican governors in the entire United States, Chris Christie, saying, oh, yeah, it works just great. We really, really like it and really appreciate it. I mean, what's a state to do, particularly if they have a balanced budget? They don't want to raise taxes and all of a sudden they've got a disaster on their hands. But beyond that, oh, by the way, I wanted to say we are broadcasting live today. Last night was the big hurricane. My apologies for not being on live yesterday, but D.C. was shut down. Our boat is fine. I'm fine. Louise is fine. Our cats are fine. Made it through just fine. So all that said. Anyhow, here's what Mitt Romney had to say during the Republican primaries about the issue of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. John King's.
Governor Romney, you've been a chief executive of state. I was just in Joplin, Missouri. I've been in Mississippi and Louisiana and Tennessee and other communities dealing with whether it's the tornadoes, the flooding, and worse. FEMA's about to run out of money, and there are some people who say do it on a case-by-case basis, and some people who say, you know, maybe we're learning a lesson here that the state should take on more of this role. How do you deal with something like that?
Absolutely. Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better.
Right, that's even better. John King then, you know, asked him to amplify, and he actually went on even farther than that. And in this rant, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. But if you can privatize it, David Selig is on the line with us. He is a conservative commentator, pro-business advocate. TrueTaxHelp.com is his website. David, welcome back to the program. David? I don't hear David. David? I don't hear him now. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to put David on hold, and maybe Danielle can figure out what's going on here. So anyhow, the bottom line here is here you have Mitt Romney saying, gee, let's just privatize this thing. Right? Let's just privatize it. We don't need no stinking FEMA. So she said the guest is there. Okay, we'll try it again. Line one is should be on the air. David? Oh, it's not a 9-11. It's not line one. That says David. Oh, it's line 11. My apologies. David Selig.
Thank you, Tom. I hope you can hear me loud and clear.
I can. It was entirely my mistake, David. I'm very sorry.
I don't believe that. Now, First and foremost, I want to thank you for having me on your program. It's such a nice diversion. I'm here at Ground Zero where the weather just decimated our area. So we've been involved in an all hands-on-deck cleanup
today. In New York City, right.
Tom?
Yes, I just for our listeners, so they know, I said you're in New York City today, so.
Yes, sir.
Back to you.
This is one of those cases where you and I stand together. I am against the privatizing of FEMA, but I don't think we should put too much stock in what Governor Romney said. It's almost as empty as, closing down a particular prison for terrorists or, peddling hope and change.
Well, that actually, if you're talking about Guantanamo, that would have been done if the Republicans in Congress hadn't blocked the funding to make it happen.
Yeah, it's a bad plan. You know, there are certain things the government must do, and I'm a supporter of FEMA. I just think it can be run more efficiently. I think we need to appoint people based on their ability to get the job done.
Then you're opposed to George W. Bush putting an Arabian horse judge in charge of FEMA, and you're in favor of President Obama hiring the guy who was Jeb Bush's FEMA director down in Florida, brilliant at dealing with hurricanes, and put him in charge of FEMA.
Well, you know, I believe in the best man or woman for the job, and particularly when I look around at the devastation in my own neighborhood and the surrounding areas, there's a place for friendship and cronyism, but I don't think it is in running these important departments.
Okay. David, thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Okay, great talking with you. We will continue this conversation, I suppose. But it's like, how is it that Governor Romney can say, yeah, we should just privatize this thing? And now he's getting a pass on this. There's two questions that I have for the corporate media, for the mainstream media. The first is if even conservative commentators like David Selig are saying, no, let's not do away with FEMA. How is it that Governor Romney, right out in front of God and everybody, said, yes, not only is it better to give it to the state, but it would even be better to give it to Bain Capital. Privatize it. I mean, just listen to this one more time. This is, clip number 6. This is Romney calling for the privatization of FEMA.
Governor Romney, you've been a chief executive of state. I was just in Joplin, Missouri. I've been in Mississippi and Louisiana and Tennessee and other communities dealing with whether it's the tornadoes, the flooding, and worse. FEMA's about to run out of money, and there are some people who say do it on a case-by-case basis, and some people who say, maybe we're learning a lesson here that the states should take on more of this role. How do you deal with something like that?
Absolutely. Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better.
Yeah, and then he went on to say, instead of thinking in the federal budget, what should we cut, we should ask ourselves the opposite question, what should we keep? We should take all of what we're doing at the federal level and say, what are the things we're doing that we don't have to do, and those things we've got to stop doing because we're borrowing $1.6 trillion more this year than we're taking in. We cannot, and then King says, including disaster relief? And Romney says, we cannot afford to do those things without jeopardizing the future of our kids. It is simply immoral, in my view. FEMA, Mitt Romney saying, is immoral in his view. Why is the media not pounding on this, number one? And number two, we know for a fact that there's between 5 and 7% more moisture in our atmosphere right now as a result of the increased carbon dioxide levels, which have been greenhouse gas, methane levels, everything else. Greenhouse gases are warming up the planet. As the planet gets warmer, more moisture is held in the atmosphere. 5 to 7% more moisture in our atmosphere now than there has been pretty much throughout the history of the human race, the last 160,000 years, certainly since we've been keeping records for the last thousands of years. And when you got 5% more moisture, you have much bigger storms. Why has nobody said, yeah, look at the size of this hurricane. Of course, with 5% more moisture in the atmosphere, you'd expect something like this. Why is global warming not being discussed in the United States?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Could it have something to do with all those clean coal and natural gas and where your lovely Chevron or ExxonMobil oil company ads on the corporate media?
Sandra, my darling, you hurt me real bad. You know it's true.
Oh, Sandy from Greece. Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Marianne in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Marianne, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was just wondering, regarding the mass media and why there's not a whole lot of attention on the fact that Tag Romney owns half of the company that is using the voting machine in
Ohio. First of all, Tag Romney doesn't own half the company. He owns a piece of a company that owns a piece of a company, both investment companies, that owns a piece of one of the voting machine companies. Marianne, I think that it's unseemly, but I frankly don't see that as any giant conspiracy. I'm not concerned about that. I think it's insane that we use electronic voting machines. I think it's insane that we've privatized our vote. And I'd like to stay with the topic, frankly, of the disaster, if you don't mind. David, I think this is a big enough topic for us right now. David in Amkenny, Iowa. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just wondered if you saw early this morning. I've been following the storm all through the night and through this morning and listening to their statements. And Pennsylvania made an interesting statement that they were asking Barack Obama to give them money for the preparation of the storm, and then they wanted money for during the storm, and then they wanted money for cleanup after the storm.
Right.
And I thought, well, okay, you know, I don't know about preparation if the government has to do that for your state, but okay. And then he started talking about...
Well, hang on just a second, David. The preparation is actually the most important part. The difference between FEMA's response to Hurricane Andrew, for example, down in Florida, where they pre-positioned, you know, trucks of water and ice, generators, equipment necessary for, you know, tents and sleeping cots and things necessary for evacuating people, made all the difference in the ability of people to survive and actually have, you know, some reasonable semblance of life after Hurricane Andrew. Whereas when Brownie was running FEMA during the Bush administration, they did none of that before Katrina, and thus you had an absolute and utter disaster during Katrina. So, prepping for the disaster, and states don't have the ability, or, you know, it doesn't make sense when you've got 5-6 states in a hurricane area for each state to completely redundantly have all this kind of hurricane preparation, when you could have the federal government control it, manage it, as charge the states ultimately for it in the form of taxation. I mean, you know, it's ultimately we're paying for it, and move it wherever it's needed.
Okay, I don't have any problem with that at all. I agree with it. The problem I had was that after he spoke of that, he spoke about individuals that might drive over water and get stuck in water, that they had a new law in place that they would take 2 points off their driver's license, give them a fine, and then charge them for the emergency vehicle to come save them. Now, everybody knows you're not supposed to drive over running water,
okay,
but there are incidences, and I live in the middle of Iowa, and there's a lot of times you have to make that choice to go over water to go to work every day. There's low-lying areas, and that stuff has
sure.
to be done.
Who's the he who said that? This, by the way?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You said he said this. Who's the he we're talking about?
Governor of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
On TV.
Okay.
So while he's asking for all this...
The Republican governor of Pennsylvania.
Everybody else... He's asking for all this money, for all this other, and I agree with that. People make mistakes sometimes, and sometimes they don't have a choice. Maybe if they're in an emergency situation, they may have somebody to go to the hospital or something like that. Now they got to worry about, well, if I get my car stuck and they have to come get me out, I better get out of my car and leave it here or whatever. I don't want to call them.
Right.
You know, all the different scenarios that can happen. And you're putting that person even in more danger, and then they're fear to call the rescue units to come help them. I thought that's the dumbest law in the world they could do.
Right.
While he's sitting there asking for all this other money, which I'm fine with, but isn't that why we pay taxes? And they pay taxes in Pennsylvania is for the rescue units to come help them, even if they made a stupid mistake sometimes?
Yeah, what you have is a Republican governor in Pennsylvania who is simply saying the Republican slash libertarian line, which is you're on your own, buddy, and if you need our help, you're going to have to pay for it. And that's not what we do in America. What we do is we catch each other when we fall. And
but
yes,
in the meantime,
people.
I want you to pay for everything else and give it to me for all my people.
No, you're absolutely right. It's also hypocritical, David. Thank you for the call. It's totally hypocritical. He's saying, yeah, I want all that federal money. Give it, give me. But by the way, if you need some help, good luck, Charlie. And, you know, assuming that what you said is accurate, by the way. So, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. David in Kanahoi, Hawaii. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, the media is a big topic today. So one thing they do is they've been ignoring the Occupy movement. So what we really need is to occupy the media somehow.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and that's what I'm doing right now. Thanks a lot for the call. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Tom, I just think how much worse the disaster would be if global warming was real. My God, this
Ed, you got to be talking with your tongue in your cheek, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is the scenario that's been painted for the year 2050.
I know.
It's a little bit early.
Yeah, you remember New York City being underwater? Al Gore talked about that and got ridiculed. New York City
absolutely.
Is underwater.
Now, the water pouring into the subway things and whatnot wasn't supposed to happen until the year 2050.
Right.
I wonder how many disasters we're going to need before they build the floodgate control that they need in New York Harbor.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a really good question. We need to be talking to the Dutch right now and the Danes, you know, about how do you do that? How do you protect against the sea coming in? And the Italians, you know, they're doing this now outside of Venice. They've been doing it for years all around Venice, but now they're getting high tech about it. And, you know, how do you deal with global warming? How do you deal with rising seas? How do you deal with, and it's not, I mean, this isn't so much rising seas, although the seas have risen by a small amount. This is 5% more moisture in our atmosphere, which means that our storms are radically more violent. And every year, every decade, actually, if you want to look at a large enough tranche, a large enough slice that it actually makes sense, look at decade after decade after decade of the severity of the storms. The 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, this decade that we just finished. Every one, it gets worse and worse.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't ask me, ask the reinsurance companies. The reinsurance companies are going crazy about this. They're the ones who have to pay the insurance companies when they go broke. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. These are actual questions. Actual questions asked to Mitt Romney in the last 24 hours. Now, keep in mind, Mitt Romney has said that FEMA should be privatized. And Shane, do you have the longer version of this, not just with the John King, but also where he says it would be immoral and all that kind of thing? Okay. Actually, I can play it out of here. I can play it from this computer. You got the whole thing? Okay. Listen to this.
Romney, you've been a chief executive of state. I was just in Joplin, Missouri. I've been in Mississippi and Louisiana and Tennessee and other communities dealing with whether it's the tornadoes, the flooding, and worse. FEMA's about to run out of money, and there are some people who say do it on a case-by-case basis, and some people who say, you know, maybe we're learning a lesson here that the states should take on more of this role. How do you deal with something like that?
Absolutely. Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better. Instead of thinking in the federal budget, what we should cut, we should ask ourselves the opposite question. What should we keep? We should take all of what we're doing at the federal level and say, what are the things we're doing that we don't have to do? And those things we've got to stop doing because we're borrowing $1.6 trillion more
and
this year
John King's
that we're
question.
Taking in.
We
cannot afford to do those things without jeopardizing the future for our kids. It is simply immoral, in my view,
right,
for us to continue to rack up larger and larger debts and pass them on to our kids, knowing full well that we'll all be dead and gone before it's paid off. Makes no sense at all.
So FEMA makes no sense at all. It is immoral because we have to pay, because the government right now, because the Republicans are unwilling to raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires and corporations, the government right now is running a deficit. Oh, and Bush had two wars that he forgot to put on the checkbook, you know, put on the budget. And he passed Medicare Part D and said that you have to pay the pharmaceutical companies a full $5 a pill for an aspirin. And they can't negotiate drug prices. Oh, and there was that Bush Great Recession that cut our revenue coming into the state, coming into the federal government in taxes because, you know, more people are now drawing unemployment out rather than paying taxes, including unemployment taxes, in. So pretty straightforward stuff. But in the last 24 hours since Hurricane Sandy hit the United States, hit the East Coast here, and to our listeners on WWRL in New York and all our listeners up and down the East Coast who have been affected, And our prayers and best wishes are with you. Louise and I rode this storm out with our three cats in a hotel near our marina. And I went over to the boat this morning. It looks like it's in good shape. I know a lot of people are not in good shape. And a lot of people have lost their power. Well over a million people have lost their power. People have lost their homes. They've lost their vehicles. A number of people have lost their lives. I mean, we're looking at death tolls now that are, if you include the breadth of Hurricane Sandy, well over 100 people. And, you know, here in the United States, dozens. And, you know, this is a real tragedy. So in the midst of this, Mitt Romney says, just privatize it. Or at least that's what he said during the primary. But now he's been etch-a-sketched. We have the new and improved Mitt Romney. Now we have the Mitt Romney who's lying to us about Chrysler. He actually said, the president, well, here, clip number five. Here, this is Mitt Romney in a rally.
I saw a story today that one of the great manufacturers in this state, Jeep, now owned by the Italians, is thinking of moving all production to China.
No, not so much. It's a flat-out lie. What Jeep is doing is they're looking at the Chinese market. It's the fastest-growing consumer market in the world right now, and they're saying we should be building Jeeps in China to sell to the Chinese. But the Jeeps we're making here in America, we're actually going to expand our facilities, our operations. We're going to build more Jeeps in the United States. But Mitt Romney's saying that and then running an ad that says it but doesn't quite say it, right? I mean, if you juxtapose a couple of factoids in a way, notice now on the stump speech, he just tells a lie. But in the ad, they said, well, let's make it so that people get the impression. Here, this is the Jeep ad lie. And actually, let's do the long version. Clip number one here, Shane. Listen to this.
Who will do more for the auto industry? Not Barack Obama. Fact checkers confirm his attacks on Mitt Romney are false. The truth? Mitt Romney has a plan to help the auto industry.
Right.
He's supported by Lee Iacocca and the Detroit News.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Obama took GM and Chrysler into bankruptcy and sold Chrysler to Italians who are going to build Jeeps in China. Mitt Romney will fight for every American job.
See, they're going to build Jeeps in China. Well, yeah, they are going to build Jeeps in China, but they're not going to move the production facilities to China. They're building Jeeps in several places around the world. So this is Mitt Romney taking a lie on the stump speech and then kind of backing it up with an ad that doesn't quite tell the lie, but communicates the lie. So back before the Etch-a-Sketch moment, speaking of his line, before the Etch-a-Sketch moment, he said that to have FEMA was immoral, that it was wrong, that it was wasteful, you know, all these things. And now, these are actual quotes that I'm reading to you. Governor, are you going to eliminate FEMA? A print pooler shouted, receiving no response. Wire reporters asked more questions about FEMA that were ignored. Romney kept coming over near the pool to pick up more water. He ignored these questions. Governor, are you going to see some storm damage? Governor, has Chris Christie invited you to come survey storm damage? Governor, you've been asked 14 times. Why are you refusing to answer the question? Really? Well, the Obama ad, or the Obama campaign, let's do clip number three here on this, Shane. This is the Obama ad that is responding to the lie by Governor Romney, former Governor Romney, who, by the way, is losing the state that he was the governor of and is losing the state that he lives in. He lives in California. He was governor of Massachusetts. He's losing both those states. Shouldn't that tell you something? Anyhow, here's the Obama response to the lie.
When the auto industry faced collapse, Mitt Romney turned his back. Even the conservative Detroit News criticized Romney for his wrongheadedness on the bailout. And now, after Romney's false claim of Jeep outsourcing to China, Chrysler itself has refuted Romney's lie. The truth?
Lie?
Jeep is adding jobs in Ohio. Mitt Romney on Ohio jobs? Wrong then.
Let Detroit go bankrupt.
Dishonest now.
Dishonest. Lie. These are strong words. And he's doing the same thing with FEMA. In the wake of this disaster, it's like, you know, he will say whatever it takes to whom, whatever it takes to get elected. But don't plan on being the truth. Jack in Newport News, Virginia. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Hey, Don. How you doing?
Good.
I heard you talk about the incident command structure and the National Incident Management System earlier, and I did this for 9 years while I was in the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
A little known fact, the people often wonder, it's like the president comes out early before disaster and he declares a state of disaster. There's a legal precedence for that with the Stafford Act and the fact that he has to do that to get money through FEMA to the states.
Right.
Now, that being said, Mitt Romney says he wants to privatize disaster management at a federal level, but I'm kind of wondering, who's going to do that?
Bain Capital.
I mean, really, who?
Halliburton. Halliburton. If Halliburton deals with disaster management in Iraq and Afghanistan, they can do it here.
Yeah, it's not that simple.
Maybe we get Eric Prince and Blackwater to do it.
Yeah, those guys are real good at doing stuff.
Well,
they showed up
in Katrina with their M16s.
Yeah, I was actually down there for 4 months in Katrina when I was in the Coast Guard. You know, a big part of that is, too, is that you can't do this at just a state level on a disaster. And a big part of that is that the disaster management agencies at a state level are all staffed by people that live in that state.
Right. And if that state gets wiped out?
Absolutely. They have to leave, and then they have their own families to worry about, their own property, their homes.
Right. Particularly if it's a small state like Rhode Island or Delaware. I mean, the damage could exceed the GDP of the state.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And to think that you can handle this on a state level actually has been proven to be false on numerous times just by the weight of the disasters we've had. BP, for example, a lot of people don't know this, is that in the National Incident Management Structure for oil spills, there is a place for the private companies. In this case, the responsible party, BP, was a huge, huge factor in the cleanup down there in the Gulf. And they had a lot of weight and say and money to bring to the table as far as how this was handled. Probably more so than they should have, because there was a case where in the news some Coast Guard men, some Coasties were actually were called out for basically telling reporters that they need to back out of an area and referred them to BP. So what happened was that the press got a hold of it. Now, I'm probably sure you're familiar with the story saying that, BP is running the Coast Guard.
Right.
That's
I remember.
The case. It's not the case, but, things get twisted. It's just funny, at a state level, you can't handle it, and at a national level, to privatize something that is really basically just a conduit for money.
But see, this is the basic Republican philosophy on everything. Figure out a way that somebody can make a buck off it, especially some fat cat Republican. If you can figure out a way that somebody can make a buck off it, that's what they're all about. And they claim that that's going to make it more efficient. And if you think that that's true, well, maybe it's more efficient skimming money off the top so that the CEOs can make millions. I mean, look at the health insurance companies. Jack, thanks for the call. You got Stephen J. Hensley, the CEO of United Healthcare, making over $1 billion. The guy who preceded him, Bill McGuire, Dollar Bill McGuire, making over $1 billion, $1,000 million. That's his compensation as CEO of United Healthcare? Really? Seriously? Yes.
Privatize it all.
Right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in a bad year, FEMA probably handles more money than United Healthcare. Can you imagine how much money they could make if they ran FEMA? Another Sandy song. Okay, all right, I got it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. We the people of the United States, the preamble to the United States Constitution, the explanation for why we are creating this government, this group, this thing that is we the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, peace at home, to provide for the common defense. Now, it doesn't say the common defense against foreign governments. I'm telling you, someday there's going to be some right-wingers making the argument, as Mitt Romney largely made in the Republican primary, that FEMA does not defend this country, or if it does, it should become a profit opportunity for Bain Capital. Yeah, let's just privatize it. I think it's the common defense. Lloyd in Framingham, Mass. Hey, Lloyd, what's up?
How you doing? I was kind of worried that you would take me right before the break, and because I've got a lot to say. I was an underwriter for the Small Business Disaster Division, and we worked with FEMA in disasters. I did it for 3 years under this liberal Democrat, worked under George Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And under George Bush Sr., incredible as it may seem,
it worked pretty well.
It worked real well.
Yeah, because George Bush Sr. was, in many ways, was an Eisenhower Republican. He actually believed the government had an important role to play. I mean, he'd been a CIA officer since he was in his
20s. Let me tell you what we did. At one time, we dealt with the earthquake in California, floods in Guam, and where I was in the Caribbean, because that's Region 1, it's Puerto Rico, and that's U.S. territory, and the Virgin Islands, under Hurricane Hugo. We had three major disasters at one time, and we dealt with them, guess what? One, two, three.
Yep.
And all at the same time. Now, one person, and by the way, we had senators come down. We had Senator Hollings from South Carolina come down when I was there. People were right on top of it. There wasn't one dime wasted. We worked 7 days a week. We also lost, by the way, two guys from dengue fever.
Oh, my.
They died
in
working for the disaster. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, dengue is also known
as real life.
Yeah, the dengue is also known as breakbone fever because it hurts so badly when you are dying from it, when you are sick
with it. That's right. So this is not fun and games out there. I listen to you every day on Sirius Radio, and when I have a day off, I also happen to be a banker for 33 years, a small business underwriter. So when I hear that from Romney, I get really angry.
Yeah.
There are people who work hard on these disasters. They die on these disasters. And to privatize it, let me get to that real quick. This does come federal money. This comes from federal money. As soon as that's why, and I come from New York and New Jersey. I was born in New York and my father had a business on 14th Street, a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. So I know all about, you know, what happened down there. I have family in Long Island who were just flooded. I'm going to tell you something. You think that money's coming from Albany or that money's coming from Harrisburg or that money's coming from, the capital?
They don't have enough money right now.
Nuts.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Lloyd, well said. Thank you for the call and thank you for your service to our country. And now we have Mr. Brown.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Yeah, well, Brownie, who did a heck of a job, he just gave an interview to the Denver Westword. And he was asked what he thought about the president's handling of this Hurricane Sandy disaster that, by the way, Chris Christie said wonderful things about, clip number 7. Here's what Chris Christie had to say, the Republican 2016 nominee for president of the United States.
How does that help you?
Helps us tremendously. I spoke to the president 3 times yesterday. He called me for the last time at midnight last night asking what he could do. I said if he could expedite designating New Jersey as a major disaster area, that would help us to get federal money and resources in here as quickly as possible to help clean up the damage here. The president was great last night. He said he would get it done. At 2 a.m., I got a call from FEMA to answer a couple of final questions, and then he signed the declaration this morning.
Wow. Okay, so Brownie was asked what he thought about it, and he said, why did he jump on the hurricane so quickly and go back to D.C. so quickly? When Benghazi happened, he went to Las Vegas. You think this guy might have a partisan agenda or something? Why was this so quick? At some point, somebody's going to ask that question. This is like the inverse of Benghazi. Right. Let's just politicize it. Heck of a job, Brownie. Heck of a job. Back to judging Arabian horses, would you? I mean, this is incredible. Mike in New York City. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I just got a question for you. You know, first of all, you know, we got to realize that Romney is an educated dummy. That's number one. Number two, you know, there's not one state in this union that can afford a catastrophe like a Katrina. You know, that's got to be understood by everyone.
Yep.
And I'd like to know from you, Tom, why is it that neither of the George Bush presidents have endorsed this guy, Romney? Do you have any idea?
None of the George Bush presidents. I didn't understand your sentence. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I haven't heard George Bush endorse Romney, you know, a Republican nominee.
I believe he has.
Or his father.
I believe Bush has, but he's done it very quietly because George Bush is so universally hated, even within the Republican Party, that he's toxic. So he's the Republicans did not invite him to the Republican National Convention. So
one question:
yeah.
Has there ever been a nominee who has stashed his money offshore before and who has signed a pledge with anyone other than the American people?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, we never have, Mike. And if we have, it's been very well hidden. Mitt Romney is probably one of the most horribly qualified people for president of the United States, given his past, given his statements, given how he's been all over the map on every single issue, given how unreliable and untrustworthy he is. I find it breathtaking that half of America is thinking of voting for him. Breathtaking.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back to our program. Craig Unger is on the line with us. He's a contributor and editor to Vanity Fair and contributor to Salon.com, the author of the brilliant book, Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power. Craig, welcome to our radio program.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Or I should say our radio and TV program. We're simulcasting as TV as well. You have written this, or this. Well, let me get into this thing, this meningitis outbreak. First of all, give us some background on this. There's this compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts that has been shipping out stuff that's been killing people. Tell us about it.
Exactly. Well, compounding pharmacies are in sort of a netherworld in terms of regulation. They are pharmacies that take pharmaceuticals and put them together in a compounded form for use. And in this case, this was a steroid we're talking about. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's often used to reduce back pain, but they are not regulated well. And in part, they're regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, but not very well. And in part by state agencies as well, such as the Board of Registration of Pharmacies in Massachusetts, which reports to the governor of Massachusetts. And in this case, you have the New England Compounding Center, is the NECC, is being blamed for really a horrifying meningitis outbreak. Over roughly 350 people have come down with the disease. 25 have died.
Meningitis being the inflammation of the meninges, is that what it's called? The tissue that surrounds the brain.
Right, the membranes that surround the brain and the spine,
right.
And this was thoroughly avoidable, but what we have is that this NECC, a pharmaceutical center in Massachusetts, appears to be taking the blame. They've been shut down now; they're out of operations now. 50 vials of the drug in question, the steroid in question, were tested, and all 50 were found to be contaminated.
With this fungus that causes the meningitis, that infects people.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly.
Which they found elsewhere in the factory. Now, what does this have to do with the Republican Party, Karl Rove, and the philosophy he's peddling, and more specifically, given that we're a week out from the election, more or less, Mitt Romney?
Right. Well, this drug, this pharmaceutical company was supposed to be regulated by the state of Massachusetts. And the governor at the time was Mitt Romney. and he appointed, he was in charge of appointing the people of the board who were supposed to be regulating this. And during his tenure at
deregulate?
It's all about deregulation. And I think what we're seeing here, I'm in.
No, wait a minute. Let me back up a little bit. Did you say that Mitt Romney appointed a board of people with the specific mission of deregulating companies like this pharmaceutical company rather than regulating them?
Well, he wants to loosely regulate. It's lax regulations. Let the companies do what they want to do. Let them do what they do best. And in this case, we see that philosophy in action. And NECC was cited for violations six times during Romney's tenure, between 2003 and 2006, which was his tenure.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, they were up for three-year probation. And the lawyer for the head of the company wrote to the board saying, well, really, that's a little bit stiff. It'll be devastating to our business. You know what? We would like to bear the burden and regulate ourselves. And that's effectively what happened. Now during this period, I should say that a New York man did get meningitis and died. There was a fatality in 2004.
While Romney was governor and was actively deregulating this pharmacy that has now killed a number of people nationwide.
Exactly. And the same pharmacy settled out of court in this case with this New York fatality in 2004.
Wow.
So there was good reason to be observant of them. And what you see in the correspondence has now been released. And when you read the correspondence, it's sort of shocking because at one point they're caught with three more infractions and the lawyer for the head of the company writes back to the board, you know what? We've taken care of all that. Mm-hmm. Period. And that's it. It's like a two or three sentence letter. In other words, we're regulating ourselves. We've sanitized everything. Everything's under control. Don't bother with us. And they just let it go, and that was the end of the so-called regulation under Mitt Romney.
And yet this company, when it was recently inspected, was found to have this fungus all over the place, was it not?
Right. Every time it's been really inspected, it's been found to have violations, so far as I know. And right now we have 25 people dead. There are well over 300 others who are suffering, and we don't know their fate yet. Well over 10,000 people were injected with this compound. It has been recalled now. I think 17,000 vials were recalled.
While it would be probably an exaggeration to say that Mitt Romney's policies or actions led to the death of 25 people, it would not be an exaggeration to say the philosophy that motivates Mitt Romney's actions has led to the death of 25 people, and who knows how many more. Or do you think I'm being too nice to him?
I think the point is, I think that there is a role for government, and a lot of the Republicans don't like to accept this. But I'm in New York right now, and Romney, of course, had been going on about making FEMA, putting all the responsibilities on the states, or better yet, privatizing it. Well, when you see a catastrophe like this, you know there is a role for the federal government. And similarly, there's a role for government when it comes to regulating pharmaceutical companies. And here you see a gross failure in that regard, and 25 people are dead needlessly.
Mm-hmm. So would it be safe to say that Romney's lax regulation might have led to this meningitis outbreak?
Absolutely. There will be lawsuits over this. I'm sure there will be more information about what the board members there were also, obviously, you have a campaign contributions. $37,000 were raised at a fundraiser for the Republican senatorial candidate Scott Brown this year by the owner of the company. Scott Brown has since, I should say, given $10,000 to the Meningitis Foundation and claimed he didn't know anything about this. But Scott Brown in July wrote a letter, was one of 10 senators who wrote a letter to the Food and Drug Administration requesting even looser regulations on these compounding centers.
Amazing.
So there you have a direct a quid and a quo.
Thus a quid pro quo.
Romney himself got small donations, but he also appointed the members, and I think more work needs to be done to find out exactly what they knew, what their relationship was to this company, and so forth.
Does now you wrote the book about Karl Rove. Does he play any role in this, Karl, Boss Rove?
Not to my knowledge, though he's been a great proponent of deregulation as well.
Right.
And I've heard him give speeches in which he says, you know, this is what's strangling this country, the regulations are strangling this country,
right,
preventing the rise.
Well, he's certainly a vehicle for shipping money from companies that don't want to be regulated to Republican candidates all over the country. I mean, he's doing that to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, Carl Rove. So, Craig Younger, contributing editor of Vanity Fair, BossRove.com. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We will be back with more. This is an incredible story. It's incredible. Mitt Romney, responsible for 25 people dead? Really? Yeah, I've sort of seen the rain, let me tell you. Stan in Detroit listening on WDTW at 1310 a.m. Oh, by the way, WWRL in New York has lost their signal. And so if you're listening on WWRL, you can't hear me right now. I'll tell you this, but if you know somebody who wants to listen on WWRL, they've got it going on their website right now. But apparently their transmitter got flooded out, so our New York affiliate is gurgling. But not in Detroit. Detroit's on the air. Stan, you are listening in Detroit. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Nice listening to you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment about the Romney commercial. I think you missed a point. He actually did lie in that commercial when he said that Obama sold Chrysler to the Italians. That's not true. What happened was, because I used to work at Chrysler, I took the buyout in 2008. But what actually happened was Daimler Chrysler had sold the company to this corporation called Cerberus, that's C-U-R-B-R-I-S.
Right.
And this is a corporation that had owned National Rent-A-Car, I think Dollar Rent-A-Car. They owned a string of rent-a-car companies.
Right.
And
it was an investment firm.
Excuse me?
It was an investment firm, sort of like Bain Capital.
Right, right. And they were the ones who ended up selling the corporation to the Italians. So I think Romney's trying to make it seem as if the president is a sellout and he sold to the Italians. That's the reason he's mentioned.
Excellent point. And it was actually owned by the Germans to begin with. So the Germans sold it to the Italians through Cerberus, however you say the name of that company. Excellent point, Stan. Thank you for calling and making it. Very well said. Chris in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was reading this morning, like I do every now and then, Madison's Federalist Number 10.
Yes, sir.
And it strikes me as being so ironic that the Republicans call themselves Republicans and Democrats the opposite, when in actuality, the whole reason for our government is the commons. And our responses to all sorts of disasters, like FEMA or fire or disease or whatever it is the whole reason that we have government, and it seems that the Democrats are the ones who defend the commons, and the Republicans are the ones who want to move towards a more purely democratic, each individual type of form of government.
Well, that's not small-D democratic, though. The Republicans want to loot the commons. That's very simple. And that's been their position since the 1870s. They let the robber barons loot the commons. In fact, a lot of the railroads that Lincoln, he gave away a lot of money. He also built a fair amount of rail, by the government, and it all got privatized during the robber baron era, much of it. But the point is, I guess that's the point, really, that the Republicans want to loot the commons. I don't see anything small-D democratic about that.
No. Well, but small-D Democratic would be acting as purely individuals, whereas Republicans would, small-R Republicans.
No, small-D Democratic is when people collectively make decisions for themselves en masse and majority rules. And what we have is not a democratic system. We don't have a republic, a Republican system. What we have is an interesting hybrid, which is a constitutionally limited representative. We hire representatives. We don't do it ourselves. Representative, democratic, yes, majority rules, republic, a nation of laws. So
Madison said number 10, that the only way to stop faction in our democracy,
right,
was to hold those people away from being able to have their own individual issues brought before the public.
That's correct. Yeah, and so, what Madison was arguing in Federalist 10 was, A, please don't create political parties. He called them factions. And B,
right,
if you do, then do not allow people to profit off their action in government as a consequence of their participation in this faction. And now what do we have? We have members of Congress exempted from insider trading laws, so that you got, you know, back when Tom DeLay was running the House of Representatives, he actually had guys day trading in his office on inside information.
Okay.
And it's still going on in among Republican members of Congress. So excellent point, Chris. Thanks a lot for the call. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on your guest from the first hour. I believe his name was David Selig.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a guest on your – he's a regular guest on The Big Picture, too, isn't he?
Yeah, he's on the TV show fairly regularly. My understanding when David came on was that he was going to support Romney and saying the FEMA should be privatized. But when he actually got on the air, he said, no, he doesn't support that.
I know, I have a comment about that, though. I wonder – since he's a corporate shill who works on a daily basis.
Well, let's not characterize David. I don't know that he's a corporate shill, and neither do you. He has his own political perspectives, but he's not here to defend himself. Let's not pick on him.
Well,
why don't you make a more general point, okay? Let's take David out of the equation.
Okay. People who work on a daily basis to make sure that corporations don't pay their fair share of taxes, effectively pay no taxes, wouldn't have a problem with FEMA coming in and saving their neighborhood when it's the majority of doctors and lawyers and professional people are paying the most of the taxes.
Right.
So, but on the other hand, when if corporations were paying for FEMA, they might not actually be in favor of.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting theory. Here's what I think. I think that we should, you know, by and large, thank you for the call. By and large, the red states get back, for every dollar in federal taxes that they send to Washington, D.C., they get back a buck and change. In other words, they get back more. By and large, the blue states, for every dollar they send to Washington, D.C., they get back less than a dollar. I think we should start referring to the red states as the takers states and the blue states as the maker states. Let's reprise Ayn Rand's language and use it honestly. Right? We got taker states and we got maker states. And the taker states, for some reason, keep voting for Republicans, and the maker states keep voting for Democrats. Maybe somebody knows something that the rest of us are missing. 27 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm just wondering, if FEMA was privatized, would it look like, what, Halliburton in Iraq? Blackwater? How would it work? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The death toll now over 30 just here in the United States from Hurricane Sandy. Mitt Romney is still refusing to answer questions about whether he stands by his position in the Republican primaries, where he emphatically said that federal funding of FEMA, when the government is operating in a deficit situation, which has been the case ever since the George Washington administration, that federal funding of FEMA is immoral, that it should be privatized. 14 times he's been asked this today so far that we know of, and 14 times he's refused to say, yes, it should be privatized, no, it shouldn't be privatized. Really, really quite remarkable. Scott in Elkhart, Indiana. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, first-time listener, got to say that I'm a little confused on how you can pick on the Republicans for trading on stock information and not also look at the Democrats do the same thing.
Well, let me tell you the story behind this. I was doing this show as well as a local show on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, about 4 years ago. And Brian Baird was the member of Congress from who represented Vancouver, Washington, which is the kind of sister city to Portland, Oregon, on the other side of the Columbia River, and areas around there. And Brian Baird came on our program and told this story. He had walked into the office of a fellow member of Congress, a Republican, and noticed that there were people day trading on their computers. And so, you know, he went back to Nancy Pelosi. She at the time was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. And he said, did you realize that in these Republicans' offices, and there was a number of Republicans who were doing this, that in their offices, they've got staff people who are day trading, and they're doing it based on inside information about what's before Congress, the trading in the stocks of, like, defense industry, things like that. And Nancy Pelosi said, no, I had no idea. And so he blew the whistle, and he blew the whistle on my program. And when he blew the whistle, a couple of Republicans came out and said, it's perfectly legal. There's nothing wrong with it. We have an exemption. And they were right. There is an exemption. Congress is exempted from the inside trading laws. So Nancy Pelosi put together legislation to make this illegal. We couldn't find a single Democrat who was allowing this inside their offices. We found a number of Republicans who could. Nancy Pelosi put together legislation to ban this. It was passed out of the House of Representatives. She was the Speaker of the House at the time. It got filibustered by Republicans in the Senate. So to this day, it is still legal to happen. And as far as I know, no Democrats have ever done it. Now, there may be some Democrat out there who is doing it. And if you know the name of them, say it on the air right now, and we will check with their office. But I can tell you for a fact, Republicans have been doing it for at least a decade. And they think it's just fine because, hey, it's the free market at work, right? And the Democrats think it's immoral because it's opportunistic use of inside information that would be illegal if you were Martha Stewart, but isn't illegal if you work for a member of Congress.
Did you happen to see the 60 Minutes article that accused both parties of doing this?
The accusation, yes, I did, and they didn't accuse both parties of doing what I just described. They did not say that Nancy Pelosi's office was doing day trading inside their office. They did raise questions about whether there were some Democrats who were profiting off their inside knowledge, but not the day trading stuff. No.
But isn't that all the same, though?
No, it's not. It is not. This is a systemic, you know, day by day, make some bucks, make a profit. No, this is a difference in political philosophy. And Scott, that's the important thing to note. Thank you for the call. Republicans think that it's perfectly okay to exploit government to make money. I mean, look at the number. Here I'm living in Washington, D.C. I can't tell you the number. Now, some Democrats do this as well. In fact, many Democrats do. The one who disappointed me the most recently was Dick Gephardt. But you look at the ranks of the lobbyists around this town. You leave Congress, or your staffers leave Congress. If you're a former congressional staffer or senatorial staffer, bang, a couple $100,000 a year is what you start out as a lobbyist if you've got a good Rolodex and good connections. If you're a former member of the House of Representatives, maybe $1 million a year. If you're a former senator, maybe $2 million a year, depending on who you are. I mean, a big deal. Chris Dodd. A couple $1 million a year. Billy Towson, the Republican who pushed through the Medicare Part D, he actually went to Congress and got an exemption from Congress to allow him to leave his job early so that he could go to work for pharma for $2 million a year paycheck. I mean, this is insane. But it is not like bad Republicans, good Democrats. It's like a difference in governing philosophy. And after that 60 Minutes piece, you heard The Republicans basically saying, yeah, so what? And you heard the Democrats saying, you know, if we're doing something wrong, we're going to clean it up. Dean in LaCenter, and by the way, I think there was a fair amount of false equivalency in that as well. Dean in LaCenter, Washington. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Oh, not much. Nice seeing you and talking with you. I usually get to the points, the amenities. But my point is here is if we had the Republicans trick in charge and we got Reagan brought through the trickle-down government or trickle-down economics, if the Romney deal gets through and FEMA was privatized, wouldn't it be like trickle-down government?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the phrase that Romney keeps saying that Obama wants to double down on trickle-down government. I've never understood what that means unless he's talking about government hiring Blackwater and government hiring, Halliburton and things like that, where it's trickling down to the defense contractors. Dean, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, I'm a little somber today, so I'm not going to yell at you.
Okay.
But these people in the storm, I feel bad for them.
I do, too.
And the one thing I want to say that's on the political nature is Romney is out there in Ohio campaigning. Now he set up a donate to me for the Red Cross Fund, right? And he's taking collections and stuff.
Wait a minute. Romney is collecting money for the Red Cross, or he's simply telling people to give money to the Red Cross? I think it's the latter.
He didn't say give money to the Red Cross. His campaign fundraiser there was turned into a give me money so I can donate it to the Red Cross.
Corky, I need to fact check that, because if that's true,
I understand that. But
that is
why don't
so egregious.
You just step off the stump and say, donate to the Red Cross, period.
Right. Well, you know, that's what we need to check out, because if he's doing that, then that's beyond the pale. But I don't want to, I have not read that, so I can't verify that. Daniel in Houston, Texas. Hey, Daniel, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm just hearing you talk about, you know, what's happening in the day trade in the Republican Congress and all this. And I'm just wondering, if we had less staffers and shrank the size of these staff groups and shrank the power of Congress and took them back to their enumerated powers, because I'm more of a libertarian than a Republican.
Well, Congress is using its enumerated powers.
Well, no.
Please name one they're not using.
Okay, Department of Education.
The Department of Education is listed under the General Welfare Clause.
The General Welfare Clause only applies under the enumerated powers.
Well, the General Welfare is one of the enumerated powers. If you define,
General Welfare is not an enumerated power. Thomas Jefferson himself said that if you allow General Welfare to mean anything it wants to, you will have tyranny.
Nonsense.
Well, that's what he said. You can check me.
Here is Article 1, right, Congress, Section 8, Powers Granted to Congress, Sentence 1. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise, taxes, oh my God, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now,
general
if the
welfare,
general welfare of the United States is not advanced by our having a well-educated populace, then I don't know what is.
I mean, it's a Tenth Amendment issue, because it's...
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is. That is. I mean, honestly, because...
Where in the Tenth Amendment does it mention education?
Tenth Amendment is anything not enumerated under the... Tenth Amendment says any powers not granted to the federal government hereof are granted to the states. And education is not mentioned in the Constitution.
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Is the Tenth Amendment.
Right.
What does that have to do with anything?
Everything.
Daniel, are you suggesting, is the bigger picture of this that you're saying that FEMA is unconstitutional too?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So you think that saving people from hurricanes is not providing for the general defense or the common defense or the general welfare?
No, again, general welfare is
what does general welfare mean? It appears twice in the Constitution, maybe three times. What does it mean?
It is defined later on by those enumerated powers. General
Where?
Welfare within the enumerated powers.
Yes, the general welfare. It says I just read it to you. That's the enumerated
yes,
powers
again,
are section
you,
8. I just but, read it to you.
That's
so what
preface,
does that mean?
That's a preface to what it says later on, because the general welfare is using within those powers. It does not grant another power by saying welfare, because it would be for the welfare of the general public to buy everyone a car, but that's not a power delegated to the federal government.
Yeah. Daniel, I encourage you to move to Haiti, the Libertarian Republic
You're
of Haiti.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or Somalia, the Libertarian Republic of Somalia. Or, you know, pick your country with very, very little government. And when the disasters happen, not so good.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man.
The news. Let's check in with the news. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Victoria, hey!
Hey, Tom!
What's going on in the world today?
Well, apart from the fact that I have power, which is the biggest news story of all.
You have power?
I have
wow.
power.
Wow. Have you been appointed a senator?
You know.
You mean electricity?
The first story. Yeah, that power. It's bigger than being a senator. It's big. it's bigger than Trump's announcement.
Well, I remember during the last storm here in town, you lost power, actually, in your home.
I've lost storm in every power going back beyond Isabel.
Yeah.
Every storm. And by the way, Trump's announcement is bigger than Trump's announcement. And he's delayed, by the way, the deadline of his announcement to Thursday because of the storm.
Trump made an announcement?
Trump made the biggest announcement. He had a bigger October surprise than Sandy. I thought you would notice. This was his huge, huge, huge announcement that was going to be very big news, which turned out to be that he offered $5 million to a charity of Obama's choice. And his first suggestion, of course, was inner-city children, because, of course, that would relate to Obama, if he produced his college records and his passport application.
Right. And this is kind of a variation on Larry Flint having offered $1 million to anybody who would produce Mitt Romney's tax returns.
Right. But he wanted Obama to produce them. It was kind of like,
right.
Say what?
Yeah, right, yeah. So
another
birther with too much money is behaving like a birther with too much money.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
So,
in real news, President Obama today visited the American Red Cross National Headquarters in downtown Washington, D.C., said this storm is not yet over. And he said he wants people affected by the storm to know that America is with you. We are standing behind you, and we are going to do everything we can to get you back on your feet. He said, obviously, this is something that's heartbreaking for the entire nation. He praised the coordination between federal, state, and local officials. He also instructed federal agencies not to say they can't do something, but to figure out how they can. No bureaucracy, no red tape.
And this is what Chris Christie was praising him for. Now, as when we went on the air two and a half hours ago or thereabouts, my clock in here says it's 6:52. That can't be right. It's 5:52. Okay. Or 4:52. Okay. Thank you. When we went on the air an hour and a half ago, or three quarters. At that point in time, Mitt Romney had refused 14 requests from the press to answer whether he still stood by his position that FEMA should be privatized and that it was immoral. Has he said anything more?
Well, I checked my tweets just before I came on the air with you, which is my most up-to-date way of checking the news.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been no tweets, and with the people I follow, there would have been, to indicate that he had suddenly answered that question about FEMA and about privatizing
so
FEMA.
So for the record, then, Mitt Romney is still in favor of Bain Capital owning FEMA.
Well, you know, his campaign did push back on that yesterday and say that he's not in favor of it, but he himself has not updated his statement in the debate during the primary, in which he told John King of CNN that even preferable to the states being in charge of response to disasters, which of course they are,
right,
under the current arrangements they are, because they reach out to FEMA,
right,
that he would be in preference of privatization. Yes.
Right.
By the way, on Chris Christie, the president will travel to New Jersey tomorrow to join Republican Governor Chris Christie in viewing storm damage, meeting with affected residents and emergency responders.
Right. I suspect we might be looking at the man who is president in 2016 traveling with the man who will be running for president in 2016.
Yes. Chris Christie, who today said to reporters, "I don't give a damn about Election Day. It doesn't matter a lick to me at the moment. I've got bigger fish to fry."
Right. And absolutely. I started to make a Chris Christie joke. I will stop right there.
Frying and fish, you don't want to go there, Tom.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. So what else is going on, Victoria?
Well, Governor Romney held what one could call an event today. It was touted as an event to support those devastated by the storm, and indeed he did receive goods, although the Red Cross has said it would prefer money. It's interesting that there was a 10-minute biographical video about Mitt Romney played before the beginning of the event, so it seems to have been a bit of a combo platter, really.
Now, first of all, the Red Cross has not just said that they would prefer to have money over goods. If you show up at Red Cross with a box full of canned goods, they will send you away, will they not? I mean, they don't have the personnel to deal with that stuff.
I don't know whether they'll send Mitt Romney away.
Yeah, okay. I had a caller to the show earlier say that Mitt Romney was collecting money. Give it to me and I'll give it to the Red Cross. Is that true?
I have not heard that. I do know that both campaigns suspended fundraising on the East Coast and have asked people to contribute to the Red Cross instead.
Okay.
Don't know whether that will continue on Wednesday, however, because campaigning is really ramping up, certainly on the Romney side on Wednesday. The president is not campaigning on Wednesday, but Vice President Biden will be, I understand, and President Bill Clinton, who is campaigning with vigor, will be campaigning on Wednesday.
Now, clip number five, Shane, real quickly. Mitt Romney said this.
"I saw a story today that one of the great manufacturers in this state, Jeep, now owned by the Italians, is thinking of moving all production to China."
Now, of course, they were sold to the Italians by the Germans. But in any case, that's a lie. Has Mitt Romney walked back that lie yet?
No. He hasn't, although the head of the car company has now not only stated that it's a lie, has now actually sent out an email to employees to reassure them that it is not true.
Yeah, because the employees are freaking out. They're like, wait a minute, you know, our job is going overseas and we didn't even know. No, actually, Jeep is hiring more people, aren't they not? Chrysler's adding?
That's correct.
Yeah, they're hiring more.
Doing rather well, yes.
Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by free-don.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tara Ross on the line with us. Tara is the author of Enlightened Democracy, the Case for the Electoral College. Tara is a lawyer and writer focusing on legal and policy, public policy issues. TaraRoss.com, the website. Tara, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. The Electoral College was born in slavery. It was part of the Grand Compromise that included two votes in the Senate for each small state. But it went beyond that. It came out of the Three-Fifths Compromise, where the individual states, the slave states, wanted to be able to have a number of members of the House of Representatives and thus a number of electoral votes for president in the mix, and yet they didn't want their slaves to be able to vote, only the white people. So, you know, a state like Georgia, you had maybe a 100-to-1 ratio of white people to slaves. And but, you know, because of the three-fifths provision, three-fifths of those slaves were counted for purposes of representation in the House of Representatives. They also counted them for purposes of representation in the electoral vote. Why should we hang on to a vestige of the slavery era?
Well, I would disagree pretty much with your whole presentation. Sorry. I know that you probably know that, though. I did not see this as a compromise that came from slavery. Obviously, none.
But it's right there in the history. I mean, you know, read the debates in the Constitutional Convention.
To the degree that we're going to say that slavery was involved, there was a discussion as they were discussing the composition of Congress. And really, if you want to talk about the Electoral College being born of slavery, you just have to say the whole Constitution really just needs to be thrown out because there was this issue going on in general at the convention.
Well, we've edited out of the Constitution, and you know, this was done in large part with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But we also specifically deleted parts of the Constitution that basically ratified slavery. Part of the Constitution that said that after 1808, after the end of the Thomas Jefferson presidency, it would no longer be legal to trade in slaves. You know, all this stuff got basically edited out of the Constitution. The word slaves wasn't used, but everybody knew what it was. You know, it was a wink and a nod. Why not edit this out of the Constitution? I'd say this is the last really serious vestige of the compromises that had to be made by the large states to keep the small states in the Union because of slavery.
If I'm hearing you right, then any compromise that was ever made to make the small states feel like they weren't going to be trampled by the large states, whether, by the way, they were one of the northern small states that didn't really believe in slavery, or if it was everybody else.
Agreed.
We just need to get rid of all of that.
Yeah, so I don't disagree.
The purely democratic system in which the small states will be trampled all the time.
No, I'm not suggesting
the Electoral College had nothing to do with the slavery debate.
If you want to get into that, I actually have a solution to that, which I think is small d democratic, and that is really simple, and that is to limit the size of a state. To say California is going to become three states, San Francisco and north, Los Angeles to San Francisco, and Mexican border up to Los Angeles, three states. Texas becomes two states. Florida becomes two states. New York City becomes its own state. If you did that, you would have far more proportional representation in the United States. Right now, our Senate does not represent the composition of the United States politically, racially, policy-wise. It just doesn't represent the United States. You've got senators from a group of states that represent less than 13% of the population who are able to block all legislation. That's insane.
I would paint this whole picture differently than you're painting it. This to me has very little to do with slavery, which obviously was an egregious institution that we are all extremely happy that it's gone. What this had to do with was with the founders' study of history and their knowledge that pure democracies implode. And the language against pure democracies.
Well, they never suggested that we have a pure democracy.
Wrong.
This was always a constitutionally limited, representative democratic republic. There was no debate or doubt about that. The question was whether you could hold these 13 states together. And the problem that you had with large states like South Carolina and Georgia in particular was that they had so few white people, white males who could vote in those states, and yet they demanded to have a say in who was president and a say in what legislation passed the Senate. And as a consequence, we have each state has two senators regardless of their population, and each state has an electoral vote equal to the number of members of the House of Representatives and the Senate that they have plus two. They're presumably their governor and their lieutenant governor rather. And you know, all of this was because of there was these large populations in these southern states who couldn't vote. But, you know, the states wanted them to be counted for purposes of the presidency and the Senate.
This had a lot more to do with the fact that they were looking for a representative government. It has to do with the fact that they were there, and really delegates from different states didn't trust each other at all. Their first allegiance was to their states.
Sure,
and
I agree.
The small states, I think, especially felt very, very defensive against the other states. You know, there's some there's this the guy, I forgot his name now, from Delaware, and he says to the whole convention, "I do not, gentlemen, trust you. If you have the power, you will use it to our destruction." And that was the kind of attitude that prevailed among the small state delegates. And the Electoral College came about because of that kind of attitude and the feeling, the belief of delegates that they could not trust people in other states and that they needed protections, that they needed protections for their own sovereignty, for their own subcultures, for their own way of life within their own states. You know, we have centralized so much in this country and moved it up to D.C. and moved it to the federal level. That is not the way things were when this country was first founded.
Yeah,
to our detriment.
You know, I think it was Oliver Ellsworth
I'm thinking Bedford. And I can't remember now if that's a first name or last name.
Yeah, okay. You're probably right.
Yeah.
In any case, he was the representative from Delaware to the Constitutional Convention. But the point is, regardless of the history of why we have the Electoral College, why it is that every state, you know, gets the number of members of Congress that they have plus two as members of the Electoral College, why keep it?
Because it works great. It is a fantastic institution that forces our presidential candidates to spread out their base of appeal, to appeal to people in multiple different
ways. Why are they only campaigning in 9 states right now?
We're in the final weeks of a campaign. This campaign is about more than just the campaign commercials that we're seeing, you know, this week and last week.
When was the last time a presidential campaign and candidate went to California or New York State?
2000, George Bush went to California and made an effort because he thought he was going to be able to win.
You don't seriously believe that, too.
And they pulled out. But there was a period of time, Karl Rove talks about it in his book, where they went to California because they thought
it was for a fundraiser.
No, he went to campaign. They thought they would win.
Well, you call it a campaign because, you're talking about 2004, right?
No, 2000.
Oh, in 2000. Okay, well, you call it a campaign stop in any case, you know, make it all, you know, nice and slick, but... You know, he was there for a fundraiser.
No, I wasn't there. I'm telling you what Karl Rove wrote. But
Karl Rove has no credibility in my book. If we had a national popular vote, wouldn't, you know, I realize there would be a problem that you could identify, you know, the 10 largest cities in America and simply campaign in them, which basically means we'd have Democratic presidents forever. And I understand why conservatives like yourself would be horrified by that. But isn't there something in between?
To go back to the swing state point, I just say a couple of things. One is this campaign is about more than campaign commercials. It is about 4 years of governance and what people think of that. And the reason California is safe is because they're pretty happy by and large with Obama and his health care plan and all of the stuff that comes with that.
But there's a lot of Republicans in California who feel totally screwed, totally disenfranchised. They don't have, you know, their vote doesn't count for the presidency.
Vote counts in a Democratic election in California to determine who is going to represent California. And yes, it is frustrating to be a Republican in California right now. But look, it's probably also frustrating to vote in a gubernatorial race in California or a senatorial race or any number of statewide races that they are having trouble with. Republicans.
Well, they just had a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay. Anyway, Tara, I meant to leave you with the last word. My apologies. TaraRoss.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Tara, thank you so much for being with us. Your book, Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Thank you, Tara.
Thank you.
Riders on the storm.
I'm detecting a theme, Shane, in the bumpers you're painting. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the True People's Media. Ed in Portland. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Stay a long time, no talk, my political sensei. You were talking earlier about financial, the Congress insider trading.
Yeah.
And I thought I remembered Obama signing a ban on that. And I did find on April 4th, he did sign a ban on that.
Mm-hmm.
Gives them 45 days to report that they've done it. And, instead of once a year. And then as I look down and I'm reading this, it almost makes it look like they have to report it and like shame themselves, but there's no real need to it. Or what? That's
right.
What I'm calling.
It is still not illegal. It is just, you know, I don't know the nuance of it, but
it's admitting it.
Yeah, I remember when that bill passed, thinking, yeah, this is cosmetics. You know, this is putting lipstick on a pig. This is not the real thing. So, because that's all they can get past the Republicans, because the Republicans are all about, hey, it's the marketplace. Let's make money. You know, that's why we came to Congress. So anyhow, Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Very excellent point. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, thank you for you and Louise for just dealing with politics every day. My question is on Electoral College. You know, like I live in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Texas, chances are, is going to Mitt Romney, and California is going to go to President Barack Obama.
Yeah.
What my wonder is, if I vote for Obama in Texas, it doesn't seem like it's really going to count. So should I go ahead and vote for the third-party candidate?
One of the scenarios that's being floated right now is that it is entirely possible that Barack Obama will that Mitt Romney will get more votes nationwide. Barack Obama will get more electoral votes nationwide. Barack Obama will be reelected president by the Electoral College, but he will have not won the national popular vote. This is essentially what happened in 2000, although the Supreme Court interjected themselves and appointed George W. Bush, which further diminished his credibility. But frankly, it was the only way he could have won, because if they had actually counted every vote in Florida, we'd have Al Gore as president in 2000. But nonetheless, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush did in the 2000 election. And so for the first 9 months of his presidency, George W. Bush was having a real problem getting anything done. Because, you know, people didn't take him seriously. They thought that he was an illegitimate president. Al Gore got 500,000 more votes. What's he doing there? And then, of course, 9/11 happened and everything changed for him. But without 9/11, I think he would have had a very, very difficult presidency. And here's
principle vote for President Obama, even though he probably won't make it in Texas.
That because if he ends up losing the national popular vote, even though it doesn't matter as to who goes to the White House, it matters a lot in the court of public opinion. It matters a lot in whether or not he can stand up and say, I have the moral bully pulpit to push through this legislation because the majority of Americans are behind me. Yes, absolutely. That's why I would do it, Robert. Robert, thank you very much for the call. As much as I, you know, and I mean, you all know my voting history. As much as I would be tempted to say, make a statement about, our political system or whatever. I just don't, with the Supreme Court at stake, with so much in the balance right now, we need an energized electorate, frankly. Jay in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, I enjoyed that argument or a discussion you had with Tara Ross a bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
But you made a good point when they also had a governor whose name was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, not just Schwarzenegger.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, well, Ronald Reagan had a big impact on our national politics. He was obviously a Republican.
Yeah, and he had a big impact on California. He ended their free college system, for example.
Yeah, well,
it was a huge impact.
I don't know how their internal politics works. I know they're a bellwether state, but obviously they've had some, and there are ISIS coming out of California as well. I mean, they have Republicans that come out of there.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, Jay, and some very powerful ones. Jay, thank you very much for the call. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Am I saying everything right here?
Yes, you are.
Hi.
Listen, first I want to just thank you. You've let us speak about the Equal Access Amendment before.
Mm-hmm.
I told you I was working on trying to get a group of people to work on it. It's about trying to fix all the voting issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm bringing it back up because you were talking about Electoral College on Thursday, mm-hmm. and you often talk about Citizens United.
Mm-hmm.
We have like about 20 things, and
I
was wondering if you would be interested in occasionally if I called and mentioned one of them and get your opinion and maybe your listener's opinion. The one we're working on right now is that the right to vote should be a right to vote.
Yes.
And then we have three things floating, people talking about whether or not you should be able to vote if you're a felon or after you've paid your debt. then you could get your rights restored. And then there's another person who's saying that you should have your rights no matter what, because if you don't feel like you can vote, then you don't have to participate in following the rules.
Right. Marcia, my personal opinion is that if you're an American citizen, you should have the right to vote, and you're over 18 years of age, period. Whether you're in prison, whether you are an ex-prisoner, whether you are, whatever. You know, I think that we should have an affirmative right to vote. I think the right to vote, the phrase right to vote, appears several times in the Constitution, that the Constitution arguably asserts that we have a right to vote. Usually, though, where the right to vote phrase appears in the Constitution, it appears in a negative context. But then the Constitution is a bill of negative rights. In other words, it limits the government in what it can do in most cases. And so it says you cannot deny the right to vote based on gender. You cannot deny the right to vote based on age. We need an affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. And, Marcia, thank you for the call. And I think that this should be put together I would love to see it in legislation, but I think it needs to be an amendment to the Constitution to say that there is an affirmative right to vote, period.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what that would do is it would raise the ability to stop things that stop our right to vote, like, you know, these voter suppression efforts. The bad and the very, very pianticously ugly. The good. Sweden. Sweden is one of the countries leading the way when it comes to finding new forms of energy. The country has a program where it generates energy from trash, and that program has been incredibly successful. The only problem? Sweden is running out of trash. Sweden is so efficient at converting waste to renewable energy that it has now begun to import almost 1 million tons of trash a year from other countries. Currently, neighboring Norway is paying Sweden to take its garbage, and future countries giving Sweden their garbage could include Italy, Romania, and Bulgaria. The energy Sweden creates from trash is enough to power 250,000 homes. So rather than burying our trash in landfills, maybe we should ship it off to Sweden. Or better yet, start our own trash power program. The bad. John McTernan. McTernan, a Christian religious leader, claimed yesterday while Hurricane Sandy was battering the East Coast that it was proof that God is systematically destroying America as a political judgment for the nation's homosexual agenda. McTernan made similar claims after Hurricanes Katrina and Isaac, too. And while claims like McTernan's are incredibly hateful and ignorant, they're nothing new. Other radical right religious leaders like Pat Robertson and Rick Joyner also routinely blame the homosexual community for natural disasters that strike America. And the very, very ugly Jerome Corsi. The Freedom Defense Fund, a right-wing super PAC closely tied to birther conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi, is airing Islamophobic attacks ads in Michigan. The ads claim that Dr. Saeed Taj, a Democratic Muslim American candidate for Congress, has an agenda that includes, quote, advancing Muslim power in America, end quote. The same super PAC has also dumped millions of dollars in Missouri in support of Congressman Todd Akin. Corsi has also promoted the conspiracy that President Obama secretly has an Islamic inscription on his wedding ring. And despite his outlandish and absurd beliefs, Corsi was once invited to ride on Mitt Romney's campaign plane. The fact that Romney allowed this conspiracy theorist and Islamophobe on his plane is disgusting, but the fact that Corsi continues to peddle his Islamophobic beliefs to Americans, well, that is very, very ugly. That's very ugly. Okay, let me just put a punctuation mark on the conversation that I had with Tara Ross about the Electoral College. For those of you, just, you know, a little history lesson here, a little history 101, first of all. When they were first putting together how to decide who is president of the United States, the founders of this country were confronted by two big problems. The first was that since this was the only thing that was a national election, right? In the state of Georgia, they voted for their two senators. Actually, they didn't even vote for their senators. They were appointed by the state legislature. you know, right up until 18 or something like that. But in any case, they locally determined within the state, they determined who their senators were going to be and who their members of the House of Representatives were going to be. They determined who were the governor and lieutenant governor, all that stuff. The one position where all the states voted for that one thing was president. And so the question was, how do we, you know, the first problem was, how do we communicate to Washington, D.C.? Actually, it was New York City at the time. George Washington was sworn in as president where Wall Street is right now in New York City. How do you communicate what the vote of the states is in a timely fashion? And secondly, you know, what if the states make a stupid decision? Because there was actually some, you know, there was a faction back then, the Federalists, who weren't all that enthusiastic about the idea of small D democracy. They, which is why they didn't elect the Senate. It's why the Senate was not directly elected for over 100 years, was because they were like, yeah, you know, we'll let the states deal with who's in the Senate. And then back in, like in Montana, when the Copper Kings, you know, Anaconda, I think it was the Cooper family, maybe not, whatever it was. This guy came in and said, $10,000 to anybody who votes for me for the Senate, for the United States Senate, right? Because he was picked by the Oklahoma Senate, Montana Senate. And in fact, we had the governor of Montana on this program talking about this very thing just a few months ago. And this is why Montana in 1918 passed a law saying that it's against the law for corporations to give money to politicians. So, but I digress. Okay, so the first problem they had was how do we communicate what the state's will is with regard to who the president should be? And the second was, how do you keep the slave states happy with regard to the president? Now, for the small states like Delaware and Rhode Island, while they were concerned about not having representation, and thus they were, you know, pleased to have two senators, they weren't quite that much concerned about who's president, because frankly, there were probably more white men in Delaware than there were in Georgia at the founding of this country, even though Delaware was a little teeny tiny state. But it was a free state. It was not a slave state. In the slave states, you had very large populations of slaves and very small populations of white people who ran them, who owned them. And so one of the ways that they solved this problem of how do you elect the president was with the Electoral College. Now, Jefferson had looked back at the Whig histories, the histories of England before the invasion by the Romans, when the British were living as tribal people, and mostly red-haired tribal people, which Thomas Jefferson delighted in because he had red hair. And he looked at those Whig histories. Paul de Rapin de Toras, for example, is the most famous Whig historian, author of the history of England before it became officially England. He read those histories and he saw that these tribes, they literally were tribes, like Native American tribes, these tribes collected and sent, each one selected a wise elder and sent that wise elder to the annual meeting where they picked who would basically be the president of the island, of the British island. Or at least that part of the British island that was England, the southern part of it. And this council of wise elders was called the Wikegemeinschaft, from the old Germanic roots of English, of Old English. And each community would pick their wise elder, and they'd say to their wise elder, well, we think that it should be Joe Blow, who's the head guy, but you vote whatever you think is best when you get there. And so the electors from the various tribes of England would go to the central place, you know, London or wherever it was. Probably was long before there was a London, but wherever it was, for the big, you know, council fire and elders meeting. And they would bring with them the will of their state, their tribe, but they also brought their own intelligence. And they'd sit around and they'd interview the candidates, and they would pick the person who was the most well-suited, weighing two things, weighing the will of their state or of their tribe and their own wisdom. Jefferson told Madison about this. Madison helped write the Constitution. He was Jefferson's protege. And that's why in the Electoral College, the electors don't actually have to vote the way that they're sent. In other words, if you when you see your ballot for president, I mean, it used to be, I'm not sure how they print them these days. It depends on the state that you're in. But very often what you'll see is that you're not actually voting for Obama or Romney. You're voting for John Johnson, elector for Obama, and Bill Billardson, elector for Romney. Because really what you're doing is you're voting for the elector. And the elector actually, under the Constitution, has the power to change their mind when they go to Washington, D.C. and cast the electoral vote, which happens after the first Tuesday in November. Or is it the second Tuesday? No, it's the first Tuesday in November. And that's the actual vote. And it's happened in the United States. It's happened in our history 4, 5, 6 times. Not a lot. But electors have changed their minds, and they have not voted the way that the people who sent them voted. But really the big issue here is cheap labor. Okay, now I've set the table for you here. I've laid out the history of this. Now what you have to understand is that the reason why the Electoral College, the real reason why the Electoral College was put into place, I mean, it was gussied up with this idea of the Wicke-Gemeinschaft, and the electors were given the right to vote their conscience. You know, they wouldn't want to vote for somebody that when they get to D.C. discovered was, you know, some corrupt guy running a house of ill repute or something. They could vote their conscience, although in Nevada that would get you the election, right? They could vote their conscience, but it was gussied up like that. But the reality was it was about the cheap labor. It was about preserving the institution of slavery and giving slaveholders extra representation originally. And now the people who are, in my opinion, supporting the maintenance of the Electoral College, it's about the cheap labor, too. Why? Because the right to work for less states have smaller populations than the union states, by and large. And they're more likely to be red states. They're more, and so, therefore, they want to have a disproportionate say. And what the Electoral College does is it gives those lightly populated, right-to-work-for-less states, the old slave states, and the states where you've got very small populations, relatively speaking, gives them more power in deciding who the president of the United States is. Now, I know in the past I have said I think that the Electoral College is vestigial, and yet we should probably keep it. I have changed my mind, and I think it's all about the cheap labor.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We used to call that cheap labor slavery. No, it wasn't free. It was cheap. You had to feed them and house them. And now we call it the minimum wage. It's all about the cheap labor.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
You tell him, Leonard. Gary in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. It's an honor to speak with you. Tom, I want to talk about the Electoral College a little bit, and I think there's a reason for it, and I think it's necessary. I know you and I see it from different lenses. You had stated that you feel that the low population states have too much power, and that's no good. And I think that's the very reason for it, is because otherwise the politicians would ignore the small states and just play up to the big population states. They would become meaningless in the election. By empowering them a little bit, if you win the Electoral College, 9 times out of 10, you win a large surface area of the nation. This empowers the farmers and the little people. Otherwise, they would ignore them and just go to New York, Texas, California, and Florida and just play in the high population areas. I think that's why they derived it. I mean, that's my opinion.
Well, that's a variation on the original philosophy was, yeah, we're a low population state. We want to have a say, too, and therefore the Electoral College. And I've made that argument before myself. That said, I think that if every single vote counted, I mean, why should it be that if you live in California, your vote doesn't count as much as it does if you live in Ohio? If every vote counted, I think instead of having 50% participation in our elections, which more or less is what we float around depending on whether it's a midterm or a national election. I think we'd have 70, 80, 90% participation in our elections. And I think if we had really, really high participation in our elections, because literally everybody knew that their vote actually mattered, then you would see politicians campaigning all across the country. And they may not go from town to town in Iowa, in rural places like Iowa, but they would certainly be talking about the issues that concern those people.
Yeah, and Tom, you have to understand that in, let's say Iowa, let's use that as an example, the farm community, they have different problems than, let's say, the people in New York City.
I understand.
And if you didn't have the Electoral College, the politicians would ignore those small states. They figure, I don't need them. I just need the population. Why waste my time going over there?
Because they do need them.
It empowers them a little bit, so they have to have something to put on the table.
No, but they will need them.
Myself.
I mean, but they will need them. It's like, here, you keep in mind, right now, the reason why they have to pay attention to Iowa is because, you know, Texas is not in play. But Texas is only going to go, you know, Texas might go 45% Democratic. And so if you had a national popular vote, then, and every vote counted, then the rural, you know, the concerns of the rural people would be just as real. I mean, all of a sudden you've got millions and millions of Democratic voters in Texas, millions and millions of Republican voters in California whose votes actually count. The candidates are going to have to respond to them, and they're going to have to respond to the voters in, you know, Iowa is not an island. We don't, you know, I would say to the extent that we have very, very local politics, you know, you could make an argument that there's a very large population of retired people down in southern Florida, or, you know, the Cuban expat community in Miami or something like that. But really, the rural issues that are, you know, the farm subsidies, for example, and farm support and what, you know, that kind of thing in Iowa, that's happening in Florida. That's happening in Texas. That's happening in California. We got farms all over the United States. Why would they be ignored?
Well, I think it's to even a power with it. You know, like I said before, I think they when they did it, now maybe it doesn't pull in as much to today's modern world, but in those days, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think they were trying to even.
Well, we've also, it. You know, we've also gone from
the low population states to be ignored in there.
Yeah, in the, you know, in the election of 1800 or in the election of 1900, a little more than a third of the entire electorate of the United States lived on farms. In the election of 1800, it was well over two thirds of the U.S. electorate lived on farms. Now it's about 3%. I think of Americans live on farms, and maybe it's lower than that now. Maybe it's down to 1%, but it's very, very small. Does that mean that they should disproportionately influence our elections? I don't think so.
Well, you see, you're seeing it from a different lens. You're seeing disproportion. I'm seeing that they feel that they have some kind of power or clout, you know. This might
but they do. They have senators.
The election,
they have disproportionate power in the Senate. There's nothing you're going to do about that unless you break up California, Texas, and Florida. And by the way, if you broke up California, Texas, and Florida, you would have a permanent Democratic majority in the United States Senate, a permanent Philip Proster-proof Democratic majority. If you took New York and broke it into two states, Texas and Florida broke them into two states, California broke it into three states, you would have enough new Democratic senators that – and by the way, it would represent the actual majority of Americans.
Well, Tom, again, I think it's because they want to give the small states some kind of power.
But
now,
why?
With the Congress, it goes by population. Like, for example, New York's got 33 congressional candidates, congressional people. I think California's got 66. So the high population states get their say in the Congress. But in the Senate,
but when you're
things
when,
up so that the small state has a little say, because otherwise they would have no say. I mean, think Connecticut now. They used to have 6 congressional people in Connecticut. Now they're down to 5 because the population in Connecticut went down. This evens up the power. I think that's what they were thinking about when they were, you know, putting the Constitution together.
But you know, when you're voting in Wyoming or Vermont, for that matter, both those states have a population of around 600,000 people, and both of them have 3 electoral votes, which means that it's every 200,000 people gets to vote for an elector. California, 66 electoral votes. What's the population of California? 38 million? Isn't it something in that neighborhood?
I would say it's pretty high.
You think that's too high? Okay, I'm sorry, I don't remember the population, but
no,
the point
know.
Is that a state that a voter in Wyoming, their vote, particularly their vote for their senator, has so much more influence on political outcomes here in Washington D.C. than does a voter in California. That seems fundamentally wrong to me. That seems fundamentally flawed. And I'd like to try and fix that. Gary, I get your point. You know, this is what I said before, is that you could just pick the 10 largest cities in America and only campaign in those. But I don't think it would work at the end of the day, because I think our cities have a lot more diversity than people give them credit for. And so do our rural areas. Gary, thank you for the call. I appreciate the conversation, one we will continue. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, it's Halloween. Look out for conservatives full of tricks. Or treats? Not so much. Take Paul Ryan's latest plan for the poor. I'll challenge the Daily Caller's Jamie Weinstein, author of The Lizard King. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.